Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this opportunity to have a conversation. I pray and ask that you be in the midst of it, that we learn something new, that we're challenged, that we grow in some way because of this moment. It's in Jesus' name I pray this. Amen. Hello, good morning, and welcome to another episode of What's the Message? I am your host, Claudia Allen, and of course, I am joined with my boss, the lady in charge, the one and only editor of Message Magazine, Carmela Monk Crawford. Carmela, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Claudia, the hardest woman, working woman in magazine history.
Thank
I know Joyner used to have the radio moniker, but you're the one. How you doing?
I'm good, man.
Good today, show today.
absolutely. Now, the reality is that racism is pervasive throughout our country and our world, Carmela. And even though it feels like the country has kind of gone back to some semblance of normalcy with the new administration, or you know, things have become a little more boring, if you would, because of new
Glad for it.
right? I'm just so excited that press conferences are just, you know, they're regular again, right? Yeah. In spite of all of that, it is still only, what, 2 months since the Capitol insurrection, right? Even though it feels like maybe that was light years away, we really still are in a very tumultuous racial time, right? And I know we had the opportunity to talk with Dr. Calvin Rock last week, 90-year-old legend, thinker, author. And he really spoke to us a little bit about liberation and desegregation. But today's guest, I really think, is going to shed some light on where we are and where we still have yet to go.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is going to be excellent. I can't wait to see what you can tell us about him.
Yeah. Well, everyone, I am so excited to introduce you to the one and only Jamar Tisby. This is the New York Times bestselling author of the book, The Color of Compromise. He is also the president and co-founder of The Witness, a Black Christian collective, and he is the co-host of the podcast Pass the Mic. Jamar Tisby grew up just north of Chicago and attended the University of Notre Dame. He went on to join Teach for America and was assigned to the Mississippi Delta Corps, where he taught sixth grade at a public charter school and later went on to become the principal. He received his MDiv from Reformed Theological Seminary and is presently working toward his PhD in history at the University of Mississippi, studying race, religion, and social movements in the 20th century. Jamar and his family call the Deep South home and especially love the weather, the people, and the food. His new book, How to Fight Racism, released in January of 2021 and is available for you to get right now wherever you buy books. And today we are really going to be having a deep conversation with Jamar about the most recent publication. So if you haven't already, just make sure that you go to Amazon, Barnes and Nobles, wherever you like to get your books, make sure you get a copy of How to Fight Racism. Jamar, thank you so much for being here.
This is my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate that introduction too.
Absolutely. So let's go in light, right? What got you into writing? Why writing?
My mama did it. She was an English teacher for high school and was obviously always very involved in my education. And she always taught us, me and my siblings, that if we could do two things, if we could read well and write well, we'd be able to do anything. Because if you can read well, if you can write well, then you can think well and you can figure out all sorts of problems, dilemmas, issues. So she really focused on that, bringing us up. And I recall her entering me unwillingly into some writing competitions. And she would just say, here, write this essay. Here's the description. Get it to me by such and such a time. And I was like, you know, this is probably seventh, eighth grade. And there are lots of things a junior high school student would rather be doing than writing an essay for some competition. But it was helpful for me because it, you know, I did well in those competitions and it said, you know, I can do this. And then depending on what I'm writing about, it can actually move people and persuade people and impact the world. So it started early on and especially through the influence of my mom.
Wow.
If I could, go ahead. Were you going to say something?
No, I just said, that's awesome. Go ahead, Carmen.
Yeah, I was going to, if I could piggyback on that early history of yours, first of all, thank you. It's an honor to have you here. And we have enjoyed reading your books and going through. And so I had to start from the beginning with the survey, as you call it, with right. The color of compromise, and then get into the how to fight racism. And so as you're going through this, and as we're talking with you right now, there's one thing that you do in How to Fight Racism that I'd love for you to share with us. You talk about writing your racial autobiography. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear maybe a brief synopsis of what your racial autobiography is and how you first sensed a calling to write on this racism and Christianity and the relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm. So remind me of the second question if I don't get to it.
I am known for the complex questions. Pardon me. Go ahead.
Well, I am known for the convoluted response, so we can help each other out. One of the most important sections of the book, I think, is a table, which is the racial identity development table, and so it talks about the process which social psychologists have studied. It's the process of becoming racially aware. And this is something that happens no matter what your race or ethnicity. So in the book, I include the racial identity development table for Black people. And there's also another one for white people there too. So I say that because as we write our racial autobiographies, in other words, just our personal experiences, our personal memories of race, what we're often doing is, even if we are not aware of it, we're walking through this racial identity development process throughout our lives. And in the very beginning, most of us, no matter what race or ethnicity you are, we begin with a state of sort of passively accepting what the broader culture says about race. And so there's this level of unawareness. You're still participating in this racial system, but you don't know it yet. You can't name it yet. You can't define it yet. So early in life, for me, that looks like going to Catholic grade school, and we had mass every week. And I remember at the Eucharist, the high point of the Catholic mass, everybody else would get up and go take the Eucharist except the Black kids. Now, I didn't understand the theology of everything. The reason why all the other kids, including white kids and Latino kids, were getting up to go take the Eucharist is because they were Catholic. They had gone through confirmation and everything. And so by that denomination's standards, they could receive the Eucharist. But the Black kids were all Protestants. Mm. And so we didn't go up to receive the Eucharist, but I don't remember anyone ever explaining it to me. So I just saw the racial dynamic there. Mm-hmm. Also about that time, I remember being on the basketball team in fifth or sixth grade. Now, I rode the bench. I am not a baller in any shape, way, or form. But I traveled with the team, and it was about the camaraderie. It was about the friendship. And I remember, you know, we grew up in a working class blue collar town. It was a harbor town north of Chicago. And our school's gym had this gym floor that was just chipped and uneven. It had been waxed over a million times. And if you bounced the ball, you didn't know where it might end up. And we didn't have locker rooms. We had to change in basically like this custodial closet before games or practice. And that's just all we knew. We didn't think it was bad or anything until we started traveling to these other schools in our conference. And I remember going to one in particular in one of the wealthier suburbs of Chicago and walking into their gym, and it had these brand new rubber floors. I didn't even know you could have a gym floor made of rubber. And mm-hmm. they had all these new logos painted onto the walls. Even the lights were brighter in this place. And I remember thinking as we walked into that gym, it's a bunch of Black and Mexican kids mostly walking into this gym. I said, the only difference between us and them is our skin color. Mm-hmm. And those are some of my earliest sort of memories connecting race to different things happening in my life.
So when did you, the second part of the question, sorry, when did you first sense, I guess I won't say a calling until you say that, but when did you sense the need to write and bring the racial history and experiences together with Christianity, and as you say in your first book, the Color of Compromise, and then want to continue that conversation? When did you get that calling to do that?
That was closer to my adult life. So there were a couple of things that happened. I joined Teach for America, and they placed me in the Mississippi Delta on the Arkansas side. And in a USA Today article in 2019, it named the county where I live is the fourth poorest county in the entire United States. Mm. And that is direct reflection of the legacy of race-based chattel slavery there. It's literally cotton country. And so you have race-based chattel slavery followed by sharecropping, followed by massive unemployment as agriculture becomes more mechanized. And these issues of generational poverty and everything that comes with it, from a crumbling infrastructure to underfunded public education to food deserts and healthcare disparities, all of that was walking into my classroom on 2 feet every day. And so it became real to me in a way that I had never experienced before. And I was invested and involved in it in a way, just knowing the kids, knowing their parents, knowing the community in a way that made these issues urgent and pressing for me. Then after 7 or 8 years in education, I went back to school to get my MDiv in seminary. And so this is in Jackson, Mississippi. And this is really when I start, as I'm building my theological knowledge, I'm also experiencing race just living in the Deep South. And Jackson, Mississippi has the second highest proportion of Black people in any city over 100,000 people. It's a city where 80% of the population is Black. So there's this another immersive racial experience combined with this drastically different theological experience because the seminary is almost all white. And so I'm trying to put these things together. Then fast forward, I get my MDiv, and through a series of events, I end up in this PhD program at the University of Mississippi. And now we're adding history to this mix of theology and race. Along the way, I've also started what became The Witness. So I'm doing these things in public. And so as all of this is happening and I'm getting trained in these various disciplines, that's what really pressed on me the need to write about it. But also from an existential perspective, we had this concentration of attention on racial issues. You know, August 2014, Mike Brown is killed. The Black Lives Matter movement becomes a national conversation. Throughout 2015 and 2016, you have this national election with this very polarizing figure, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about race in a way that makes it all pressing. So all of those things combined made me want to write about these issues.
No, that's so good. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about your work in both How to Fight Racism as well as in The Color of Compromise is you provide a history of race and racism that is intimately connected to religion and theology within the US context. And typically within most race conscious books, the conversation is always devoid of the theological, or it is devoid of the religious, almost intentionally so. Whereas in How to Fight Racism, you very clearly assert that fighting racism is a Christian imperative because racism was a Christian invention. Can you talk to us a little bit about that history and draw those lines for us?
We cannot properly understand racism and white supremacy unless we understand its religious dimensions, specifically its Christian dimensions. So in The Color of Compromise, we can go all the way back to the colonial era. And one of the landmark laws that was passed really sticks out to me. It was in 1667. Mm-hmm. And the Virginia Assembly, which was a bunch of white Episcopalian men, so Christians, passed a law that said baptism would not emancipate an enslaved Native American person of African descent or mixed race descent. And they're doing this, they're passing a law about religion based on race. Mm-hmm. And there's so many examples throughout US history where Christianity is being deployed in the name of white supremacy and being constructed under the ideology of white supremacy. So you can fast forward to the Civil War, and there were literally what historians call pro-slavery theologians. Mm-hmm. They were using their prodigious intellect in a twisted way to make their theology conform to this ideology of white supremacy. And so there you get things like the Curse of Ham that says people of African descent are by nature in the Bible sentenced, mm-hmm. condemned to lifelong slavery. Most people were monogenesis, meaning they thought all human beings descended from the same forebears, but you had some polygenesis who thought that people of African descent were literally a different species, that Adam and Eve, that's where white folks came from, and Black people came from some other source, like animals and apes. So you have folks doing things like this. Of course, you can fast forward to segregation in 1950s. There's a guy named G.T. Gillespie, who was the former president of Belhaven College, now University, gives an address to a bunch of Presbyterian pastors about the biblical case for racial segregation, right? And then throughout the civil rights movement, you have, you know, white evangelicals many times on the side of segregation and racism. And even to this day, we have people essentially, you know, slavery apologists in 2021 basically saying, you know, slavery wasn't that bad, kind of a thing. So religion, and specifically Christianity, has always been in this mix. And the thing is, Robert P. Jones wrote a book, his most recent book is called White Too Long. And, mm-hmm. and he's the head of the Public Religion Research Institute. So his book is packed with data, polls, statistics, and basically all of it shows that being white and Christian makes you more likely to be racist and makes it so that you hold on to those racist beliefs more tightly, which is haunting.
Yeah. How is that possible? Yeah. I think that's the, because it's like, and based even on your exegesis of various scriptures from Genesis to Revelation in the book, you show that that's not a proper interpretation. However, how is it that Christians are more likely going to be racist? Where are they getting this theology that is supporting their superiority complex?
Right, right. So, I mean, from a philosophical perspective, I think it reveals that oftentimes we retrofit our theology to fit our ideology, and that we follow the culture first rather than Christ. So a lot of this, that what we're seeing is racist people who are racist, then going back to the Bible to justify their racism, right? But then now their bigotry is baptized in the Bible, which makes it have a lot more sticking power, because it's not just what I believe or a political party believes, this is what God is teaching. Mm-hmm. And so to disrupt or uproot those ideas is to disrupt and uproot foundational religious beliefs that sort of guide their entire existence and way of being in the world. But what they fail to realize is that what they're oftentimes following is not Christ, but whiteness, as Willie James Jennings says, it's a way of being in the world, a cognitive and affective seduction into believing in one's own superiority, and that one has the authority to determine what life should look like, not only for yourself, but for others as well.
Wow.
Absolutely.
My mind is blown, and I'm having a hard time, just as I was when I was reading this. But, you know, I have a strange question. When you were writing this book, who were you thinking about in terms of your audience? Were you writing this for white Christians? Were you writing this for Black Christians? Who?
Yeah, I wrote it for the coalition of the willing. So first of all, who I did not have in mind were the trolls or the folks who I call in the book racial justice resistors. I had the hunch, which has since proven true, that no matter what I wrote in the book, there were going to be plenty of people who simply reject it out of hand. And that's what happens. There are some really, really awful reviews about the book floating around out there. And it was just so interesting because I had this morbid fascination to see how they got to their rejection of the book, because there is a lot of sort of Bible in there. Now I say that and I want to make clear that the Bible, the book is not exclusively meant for Christians. I went back and forth on whether to include that phrase courageous Christianity in the title, because I think it's a book that's helpful for all kinds of people, whether you are Christian or don't claim a faith tradition at all. I think the racial justice practices are applicable for anyone. But I wanted to make sure, going back to our previous conversation, that Christians were part of the solution, because they've been historically, white Christians have been such a big part of the problem. So as I'm thinking of people, I'm thinking of the coalition of the willing, many of the white Christians who are deconstructing their theology, understanding that this sort of culture wars Christianity is not the Christianity of Christ, and are increasing their awareness about it, but want to move to the next step, basically, or add to that and actually take action. I'm thinking of Black Christians who, if you're like me, we are constantly being asked in various ways, what do we do about racism? And right. We aren't the ones who invented the problem, but we are being tasked with fixing it so often. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to save us some breath and say, you know, yeah. Here's a book.
Here's a book.
Literally answering your question in, you know, tens of thousands of words. So, you know, yeah. You and call me in the morning kind of thing.
I think that that's so great. Yeah. You know, one of the core tenets of the model is relationships, right? Mm-hmm. ARC. And one of the questions that I had is, you know, you do make that statement that, you know, many of us Black folk are tired, right? We are tired of explaining racism, with, you know, bearing the burden of fixing racism. So my question then is, how does the model work if it is not in some way dependent upon Black folks' participation in in educating and mending and fixing and, you know, being white people's safe space to ask the hard questions, right? Like how does the model work if Black people were to at any point refuse to be that safe space?
Great question. It doesn't work if Black people completely extricate themselves from the problem and the process. So it's one of those things in life that's not fair. We didn't create the problem, but we do have to be part of doing something about it. But what I want to challenge readers to think about is, how do we make sure that Black people and other people of color aren't unnecessarily participating in the process when a lot more work could be done on the part of white people to equip themselves? And so what I want to challenge white readers to do is to do everything you can in your power to access the resources and answer the questions that you have before going to your Black friend or your friend of color, right? Yeah. And, you know, two of my favorite words in answers to any of these racial questions are just Google it. You know, we live in the information age. Find out anything you want, from, you know, statistics to, you know, the latest issues of voting rights to the history of all this stuff, right? The knowledge, the information is out there, but it is really easy to just sort of say, oh, I don't understand this race thing. Let me go ask my Black friend. Not realizing that you as a white person are probably the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 20th white person to come to that same Black person asking about this issue. So we're tired for sure. I also want to challenge Black people and people of color to self-care, right? Part of what we have to realize about racial justice and the journey is that it's a marathon, not a sprint, and we have to pace ourselves. Pacing ourselves means putting up healthy boundaries. Those healthy boundaries can look like, I have a whole section on Black mental health care and making sure that we have therapists of color who are trained in these things, and white therapists as well, but also increasing the pipeline of Black mental health therapists. Part of setting healthy boundaries and pacing ourselves is being able to say no to particular requests and conversations that every white person who approaches you, even in good faith, it may not be a good time for you to engage in that. You may need to do some healing and have some rest before you engage in that. So I want to challenge, you know, white and Black readers to make sure that Black folks, yes, we've got to be part of the solution in some way, shape, or form, but that doesn't mean we have to be part of it in every way or at all times. And we need to have some healthy boundaries around it.
I have that temptation. I've always had that temptation to feel that, okay, well, I look around the room, I'm like, okay, here it go. Here I go. Now I got to say this, and I had to be on point. You know what I mean? I have to have my citations correct. I have to have my carriage and my bearing the right way. And I have to speak in a way that is non-threatening, which, like you say, for a troll, it doesn't matter how you present. It doesn't matter. And it's not going to come across. My question to you is, you know, because a moment ago you said, you know, okay, speaking of the trolls, you know, you wanted to see, you know, you've got scripture in there and people who are so-called Christians, it seems like it's pretty straightforward. I'm asking the flip side. Have you ever seen anybody, quote unquote, renounce their white card? And in doing so, what do you know to be the persuasive, maybe scripture or approach for them?
Yes, I have seen people sort of have the light bulb go on. Just a couple of weeks ago, somebody was tweeting about the book and tagged me, and it was a middle-aged white guy. I'm not sure where he grew up, but sort of the core demographic of like white evangelicals who don't get it about race. And he sort of admitted as much, but he said these words that I'll never forget. He said, "You got through to me." Mm-hmm. And that was powerful. And I've been in a couple of situations back when we could speak to folks in person, and folks would come up to me afterwards. And there was this particular instance where an older white gentleman and his sister came up to me. His sister introduced him, and this older white gentleman with tears in his eyes was talking to me about how he had been born and raised racist, how he had been racist all his life and never realized it, but how reading The Color of Compromise in that case and understanding this history had really pierced his heart. And like I said, with tears in his eyes, he was saying, you know, this changed me and I wanna do differently now. So you have those stories. You know, I'm not doing a documentary of these folks. I don't know how the trajectory of their life is shaping up, but I take them at their word. And so when you ask what has been persuasive, one of the things is history. And my burden is that, you know, ask virtually anyone, and we can all say that racism has been a big problem, but can we talk about it in detail? And I find that when we read history and we learn the details, the names, the faces, the places, the events surrounding racism, it hits different, mm-hmm. right? We move beyond the impressionistic to the specific, and that's the gut-wrenching part. So when I talk about the lynching of Luther and Mary Holbert and how they used a large corkscrew and yeah. bored it into the flesh of these human beings, these image bearers, and tore out chunks of quivering flesh, as one paper reported at the time. When I talk about how Baptists had made a gesture toward abolition at the General Convention in the 1790s, and then they sent this resolution back to the local congregations, but the local congregations threw such a fit that the General Convention rescinded that resolution against slavery, mostly to play to the comforts of wealthy white slaveholders. And this is also in the North, not just the South. So my point being, when you learn the specifics of history, it evokes an emotional response, which can lead to empathy. Empathy is the foundation of solidarity and anti-racist action. Until we can sort of understand one another on this human level, that these are other human beings who are suffering because of racism and white supremacy, that hurts me like it hurts them. When mm-hmm. one part of the body hurts, we all hurt, right? Until we get to that point, we can't really make progress. So history is one. If I can name just a couple other things. Personal testimony mm-hmm. often is a good entryway into conversation. So many people, especially the folks who are sort of most adamantly opposed to any idea of racial justice, they're not going to read the book. They're not going to read the article. They're going to call CNN fake news. They're going to be inoculated against sociology, psychology, data, statistics. They ain't going to believe any of that.
Yeah.
What they might believe or at least listen to is you.
Mm-hmm.
So especially this is for white people talking to white people in particular, but I think it applies to anyone. When you tell your story of why and how racial justice became important to you, you're essentially sharing a testimony. Mm-hmm. And a testimony of one's personal experience of, you could even call it a conversion to, you know, racial justice and opening up to this form of being a disciple of Jesus in the world. When you talk about your personal experience there, you know, the person you talked to, the book you read, the event that you witnessed or participated in, that's a little bit harder to argue with, right? Because we're not talking about some scholar's interpretation of information. We're talking right. about your own personal experience. And you have the added layer of a personal relationship with that person. So they may not agree with your views on racial justice, but they care about you as a person because mm-hmm. you're a family member, a friend, a coworker, whatever it might be. And so starting with that personal testimony, even before you get to some of the history, can at least open up the doors of conversation. And then lastly, mm-hmm. I would never assume that even though people call themselves Christians, they actually know what the Bible says about race and ethnicity.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And so that's why I include a pretty lengthy section in the first couple of chapters about the image of God and a brief biblical theology of race, because we got to have a basic overview of the landscape of the Bible and how God is working in racial and ethnic diversity and equity from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
from Genesis to Revelation. And be able to walk people through that story or at least a few particular parts of scripture to demonstrate these are biblical imperatives, not just sociological initiatives.
Can I say that I'm not mentioning any names, but I had a situation recently where I presented and a white person followed me and they used the phrase, you know, and I think really they had a good heart. You see, you can tell I'm trying to be very gentle about this. They had a good heart about it and they're a very nice person. But I guess they were saying, yes, we have to read. And they were recommending a book because they felt that that person handled the material with quote unquote or without undue passion. And I thought that was so strange to me, because when you're saying, I'm going to these very dramatic situations and historical accounts, fact written in the history book, persuasive scripture. Right. And it is hard not to relate. First of all, I'm a Black woman. It's hard for me not to be passionate. But I was in that moment, I was stunned that the passion and the emotions and the conviction that could be evoked is the very thing that's pushing people back.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You're hitting on such an important point. What tends to happen among certain people is they want to intellectualize an existential experience. And by intellectualizing it, they can distance themselves from it. And so we see this all the time. Right now, you know, there are a few talking heads that style themselves experts of critical race theory, even though they have no training in law, which is where it has its primary application, no training in sociology or social psychology, which would have bearing on this, no training even in history. And what they're doing is they have this veneer of politeness, of detached, unbiased, I'm just evaluating both sides. And through this scientific evaluation, through logic, then clearly, you know, critical race theory and all that goes with it is anti-biblical and Christians can't get behind it. But because they put on this mask of intellectualism, it seems more palatable. Can we go back to the 1990s and Charles Murray writing the book, The Bell Curve, which he's saying that you know, there is an inherent intellectual inferiority among certain parts of the population, namely Black and brown people, right? But because it's in a book and because he's got some credentials and because he's presenting it in this academic way, it seems to have validity. Oh, we could go on and on. I don't know how you can read history or read the Bible and not be passionate. You know, that to me, to have this veneer of being dispassionate is it makes me question, did you read it? Did you understand it? Did you grasp it? Did it grasp you? And it's a form of sort of theological colonialism, that sort of European and white normative standards around affect and emotiveness are imported and forced on other cultural groups that have very different and equally legitimate standards for what emotional expressiveness looks like and what is and is not permissible in certain contexts. So don't let, you know, just to the listeners, don't let people who seem to wear this intellectual hat fool you into thinking that that is the proper or superior way to respond to events and circumstances and realities that are highly emotional.
One of my favorite quotes in the book is, and I'd love for you to respond to this and then maybe even segue into the purpose of the witness with this. But you say, milquetoast sermons about all people being equal in God's sight and injunctions to treat everyone fairly is like going for a swim and calling it a shower. You get wet, but you don't get clean. Talk to the people about this right here, Jamar.
Ooh, you really trying to get me fired up on today.
It's what I do best.
I am sick and tired of really weak sermons and teachings from Christians on race. Because even the most staunchly segregationist, backwards thinking white Christian pastor would say something like, all the ground is level at the foot of the cross. Even slaveholders at a certain point, not initially, but at a certain point, would promote the conversion of enslaved people to Christianity, right? So it's the bare minimum, the bare minimum, the least, as the young folks say, to say that Black and white people and other people of color are equal. Mm-hmm. Duh, we know that, but that's not transformative and that's not prophetic, yeah. right? It's mm-hmm. what Martin Luther King Jr. called pious irrelevancies and vain trivialities.
Mm-hmm.
Just hot air. When you don't talk about justice, when you don't talk about equity, when you don't talk about power sharing, when you don't preach to the idols of your congregation, and mm-hmm. for many right now, it is Christian nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. When you don't name those things and be specific, when you don't talk about how racism evinces itself in policy, and mm-hmm. so that we must promote as Christians voting rights.
Right.
And that's not a partisan issue. It's not Democrat or Republican. It's just saying in a democracy, everybody who's eligible should have the right to vote, and it should be easy, not difficult. You know, mm-hmm. those are the kinds of things where the rubber meets the road. And so often, you know, church leaders, teachers, whoever it might be, skate by saying, you know, I believe all people are equal. Okay, so what are you doing to actually bring that about? And if you have a position of leadership and teaching within the church, what are you doing to disciple your people into that? Because it's going to make some people mad.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who don't do that.
Yeah. Speaking of making people mad and something that is the opposite of a milquetoast sermon, I want you to go straight there when you talk about ecclesiastical reparations.
Yes.
To me, that was in the first book, wasn't it? But yeah, I mean, you kind of break it down in both of them. The whole idea that we could start, because this is something else that, you know, we came up recently, we encountered where, you know, we want to put out a statement, and many people want to put out statements today. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I condemn this. We don't like this. For me, that is dissatisfying only mm-hmm. because it ends. You know, we look good. We put it up there. It's on our social media. I'm like, let's go down to where the rubber meets the road. What are you willing to sacrifice and give up? And so when you talk about a church or a church organization stepping down into the water, yeah. what would that look like to you?
That's right. So I borrow that term, ecclesiastical reparations, from Presbyterian Korean pastor Duke Kwan. And he's co-writing a book with another guy, Greg Thompson, on reparations. And basically what Pastor Kwan is saying is the church doesn't need to wait on the federal government to enact reparations, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a legitimate application here. In the Gospels, it says, you know, if you know that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift at the altar, go be reconciled to that person, and then come offer your gift, right? So, mm-hmm. so it's the idea that if you know there is a ruptured relationship, if you know that there is repair that needs to be done between you and other people, God doesn't want our sort of hollow worship. He wants us to go be reconciled with one another and then come offer your worship in truth and in spirit, right? So if we look at that on the corporate level, white Christians, if you've been paying attention at all, know that your Black brothers and sisters have something against you. It's called racism and white supremacy. It's the legacy of race-based chattel slavery, Jim Crow segregation, the continued inequities around race that permeate our society. We know that's the reality. So what are we waiting for? Leave your gift at the altar and go repair that relationship. And so ecclesiastical reparation says, what can churches, what can Christians do with their money to bring about equity across racial lines? And so there are lots of ways to do this. There's a church in Florida that for all of its events, it utilizes vendors of color mm-hmm. to do the food and whatnot. So they're patronizing Black businesses is one way to do it. That same church also had a relationship. The white pastor of this predominantly white church had a close friendship with a Black pastor of a Black church, heard they were in financial trouble, had been months and months and months behind on their rent. And so this white church opened up its doors for the Black church to worship there for free. I heard of another story recently where after reading the book and that section on Black mental health therapists, a congregation is forming a scholarship fund for Black people who want to be mental health professionals and to help them fund their education, right? There's other ways that churches can enact financial reparations. I was talking to a white Christian who had been raised in evangelical circles. And as a young lady, even in her teens and 20s, she didn't know there was such a thing as a bivocational pastor. She was going to this big white church that had full-time everything, huge, you know, there's a children's pastor, there's a youth pastor, there's a young adults pastor, there's the senior pastor, all of them full-time employed, getting salaries and everything. Meanwhile, so many Black people and people of color are doing pastoring on the side. It's not their main source of income, and they can only give to the job what they can afford to give with the time they have left after they work their full-time job. So what if churches paid for a full-time salary? So these, you know, Black pastors could devote more of their energy to the local congregation and community. We can go on and on and on, but the question for us all to ponder is, if we know that these racial inequities exist because of racism, what are we as followers of Christ going to do about it? And are we going to take our cues from the culture and the government? Or, like King said, are we going to be the headlight and not the taillight and lead the way?
That is that powerful. Could you then talk to us a little bit about what your mission and purpose is at the Witness Collective?
Thank you. Yes. So we recently expanded, and we are the Witness Incorporated, one organization with two divisions. So the one division that most will be familiar with is the Black Christian Collective. That is our multimedia arm. We are telling the expansive story of Black Christians and doing that through blog posts, videos, events, you name it. Our newest division is the Witness Foundation, which I'm really excited about. It's our philanthropic arm. And these divisions sort of work together like word and deed. So the BCC is putting words to our experiences. The philanthropic foundation is putting it into action. And we do that mainly through a fellowship program. It's a two-year fellowship. Our inaugural cohort, which will launch later in 2021, is going to consist of five promising Black Christian leaders who are already involved in justice in various sectors. And what we want to do is train them. We'll pair them up with a mentor. We'll do some professional development with them. But we also want to fund them to the tune of $50,000 apiece for each of the 2 years of the fellowship program. So a total of $100,000 investment, because we believe that much in Black Christian leadership. And we want to see the next generation of Black Christian civil rights leaders in the 21st century. So all of that is, you know, fits right in with the books and my sort of personal mission and ministry. And it's about the we, not the I, in all of this. We have to build institutions. We have to build our own tables. We have to pull up a seat at the tables that we've built and then interact with other folks on the basis of equality and come to the table as equals, not begging for crumbs at the table of white supremacy.
Wow, that's amazing. How do you feel like this work of really building up the Black voice, really building up Black leadership, focusing on the uplift of Black people, now connects to the work of racial reconciliation?
Well, I think it's, you know, so many of us Black folks just need to hear that we're not the only ones. You know, so often we are in these predominantly white environments, we're being gaslit, we are being, you know, ignored, our experiences are being minimized. And this can happen in the workplace, in schools, in churches. And what's so exhausting is that we spend so much time and energy just trying to convince people that what we say is real is actually real. Yeah. And so what I think the Witness does is it provides that sort of safe haven for other like-minded folks to say, you're right. The things that you're experiencing are real. And whether people understand that or not, and here are some other folks around who get it as well. So I hope it's a place of refuge. I hope it's an organization that can help rejuvenate people. And how that connects to the work of racial justice and racial reconciliation is that pacing I'm talking about, that marathon I'm talking about, so that we're not constantly just giving and giving and giving and putting out our energy, but we can reclaim some of that energy, reclaim some of that strength to go out and then interact with white folks who have never experienced racism like we have, and not body slam somebody in the process, right? You know, because we've had a place to process it in a healthy way. So that's how I think, you know, we need these communities where we can sort of relax, be ourselves, speak in the vernacular that's comfortable to us, connect to the cultural touch points that are familiar to us, whether that's, you know, stereotypical things like, oh, I love the debate on Twitter. Do you put sugar on your grits? Yeah.
Right. That's probably where we should have started.
You know, so we will.
He's in Mississippi.
The conversation's
polarizing. He does it the right way. He's in Mississippi. He does it the right way with the salt and the butter.
But see, my parents were raised in Michigan, and they put raised with sugar putting on it. So I've had both. I feel like this conversation is polarizing enough. We don't even need to go there.
We don't need to go there.
But anyway, we need those spaces. Well, you know, right?
I think it's so beautiful that what you said a moment ago about investing in young Christian leaders, and that the name of your foundation and your organization is The Witness, because I guess right now the conversation is very strong with so many of our Black young people questioning, do I want to be associated with Christianity that has such a long history of corruption? And so I guess my question to you is, have you ever felt like you wanted to lose faith, and how do you empower young people to keep going?
By God's grace, no, I've never thought seriously about leaving the Christian faith, because I knew Christianity was much more than what white people made it. There's wonderful scholarship being done now on the early African origins of Christianity. I would point listeners to Vince Bantu, B-A-N-T-U. Just Google his name, and he's got a couple of books out about it. Lisa Fields at the Jude 3 Project has some podcasts on the topic with interviews from scholars and experts. So what we have to realize is that Christianity was around a lot longer and before whiteness, right? And that even many of the earliest Africans who were forcibly brought to North America were Christians themselves. They practiced a combination of African tribal religions, as well as some Muslims, but there were also a contingent of Catholic Christians there, including some folks, historians speculate, some folks who came to the coast of colonial Virginia in 1619. So Black folks had Christianity long before Europeans had it, and long before this construct of whiteness arose in our society. So that's one thing, the historical aspect. The other aspect is looking not just at white evangelicals, not just at Christian nationalists, looking at the Black church tradition and seeing that not only was Christianity used as a force of oppression, Christianity has also been the motivation for liberation. Among lots of different marginalized groups, and specifically Black Christians. And so as I look at people like Ida B. Wells and Fannie Lou Hamer and Medgar Evers, who were all devoted Christians who also dedicated their time and energy and even sacrificed their lives for the cause of justice, not in spite of or as an addendum to their Christianity, but as core and central to their Christianity. So that makes me say, you know, we have this great cloud of witnesses. How could I abandon the faith because a few white people want to, in the name of ungodly, sinful ideas corrupt and co-opt the Christianity that Christ taught.
Wow. In closing, is there anything that we didn't ask you in the book that you really want to share with people? And then as you do that, feel free to tell them how they can get the book. If you have any other promotional events, anything that you want to share with people on how they can get involved with you and your work.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about The Witness. And we are in the midst of our first formal fundraising campaign. It's called the Will You Be a Witness campaign. And it's your opportunity to really put your flag in the ground in this moment of racial reckoning that we're experiencing right now. So we would love for you to financially support this campaign. We're trying to raise $500,000 to fund this ministry. You can go to thewitnessinc.com. You can go to thewitnessinc.com, make your undesignated donation, or you can specify whether it goes to the Black Christian Collective or the foundation. I would love it if folks followed me on social media. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Jamar Tisby, and on Facebook at Jamar Tisby and the number one. And then you can also go to the jamartisby.com, and you'll find links to both of my books, The Color of Compromise and How to Fight Racism, at jamartisby.com, and also sign up for my newsletter there. So that, and the last thing I want to say is just to leave people with some practical steps. The book is called How to Fight Racism. It is a book that throughout prioritizes the practical. There are literally dozens of actionable steps that you can take. One we talked about earlier in the show, write down your racial autobiography. And let me break it down even more. Just write down in a couple of paragraphs your first memory of race. Could be when you're in kindergarten, it could be much later. Write down your first memory of race, what you felt, what the situation was, and then see where that leads you. Maybe you keep writing, maybe you put the pen down and just ponder and pray over it. Another thing to do, it's really hard to build meaningful relationships across racial and ethnic lines. Mm-hmm. I find that the best way to do that and not treat people like projects is you get involved in some activity where there's a bigger goal. And then along the way, you get to know people. So if you think of sports, right, your goal is to win the competition or beat the other team. And it's in that process that you develop a sense of camaraderie and deepen your relationships with other people. So whether that's getting involved in the parent-teacher association at your school, a civic club or group in your community that is assembled for some different broader purpose, but it puts you in contact with people from different races and ethnicities with whom you can develop authentic relationships. Think about in your own situation how you can be involved in those groups. And then lastly, I'm basically following the ARC model: awareness, relationships, commitment. On the policy level, the House of Representatives and Congress just passed H.R. 1. It is a sweeping voting rights bill that would be the most extensive since the Voting Rights Act in 1965. It's passed through the House, but it's got a very narrow path in the Senate. Most people don't think it'll pass because of the filibuster. But if you can call your senators, if you can write to them in support of H.R. 1, which would expand and protect voting rights, which has always been a struggle for Black people, then that's one way to get involved on a systemic level.
That's amazing. Man, thank you so much, Jamar, just for spending a little bit of time with us here at Message. Everyone, like I said before, make sure that you get your copy of How to Fight Racism today. We've put the link in the bio, and also make sure you are following Jamar Tisby as well as the Black Witness Collective and The Witness Inc. This has been another phenomenal episode conversation here on What's the Message. And like I always say, next week, we'll be right back here. Same time, same place, just a different conversation. And I am excited about next week's conversation because next week we will have Now, Dr. Wesley Knight wrote a book called Thirsty a couple years ago. And in this book, he talks about the connection between sex and sexuality and the spiritual. But this time, he and Pastor Cadet come together and they want to ask the question, are you still thirsty? And in this book, they dive even deeper into this correlation, even discussing some things around that of sexual misconduct within some of our spiritual and religious church leaders. And so this is a conversation that you absolutely do not want to miss. You want to make sure that you are right here on What's the Message on Facebook and YouTube, where we can dialogue and answer the question, are you still thirsty? How can you fill that God-shaped hole that is really causing you to engage in illicit sexual activity? All right. So make sure you are right here. Of course, make sure that you are subscribed to Message Magazine. Make sure you're getting our bi-monthly magazine. Go to www.messagemagazine.com where you can purchase your subscription. We have an amazing issue coming out for March and April that you absolutely don't want to miss. And remember, if you don't want the print issue, we have our new digital magazine ready and available right now. So get your print copy or your digital copy of Message Magazine right now on www.messagemagazine.com. You can like us on Facebook. That is the only way you're going to be able to get reminders about this podcast. Now, you ask me all the time, weekly, Claudia, send me a reminder about the podcast. And I'm telling you, if you like the Facebook page, Facebook will remind you about the podcast. All right. So make sure you have liked the Message Magazine Facebook page. Make sure you have subscribed to our YouTube channel. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Message1898. All right, guys. Have a great one. Thanks. Bye-bye.